Well, it's one story after another. It's just amazing how many we have to hear. Recently, President Wilkinson of the World Bank responded to people asking for debt cancellation by saying that the notion that for someone to come along and forgive the debt is whimsical. Of course, at the same time, they talk about poverty reduction, but people like our next speaker, Kevin Danaher, are responsible for making people like Wilkinson sound totally ludicrous and whimsical themselves, that the fact that they can actually ignore the demand of the communities around the world. Kevin is the director of public education for a non-profit organization called Global Exchange, and he is in... I think I'm going to not say the rest. Well, he's inspired generations of students and community groups to oppose this elite globalization. In his previous life, he used to be a professor at American University and a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and Institute for Food and Development Policy. We still miss him there. He holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California. He's lectured at universities. That's why a lot of us know him here and are cheering for him. Kevin, did you pay for these people to be here? A regular contributor to the editorial pages of U.S. newspapers and a frequent guest on talk radio. He has authored numerous books and articles on global economy. Many of us have read Corporations Are Gonna Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream. And his latest book, co-edited with Roger Burbach, is Globalize This, The Battle Against the World Trade Organization and Corporate Rule. I don't have to ask you to give him a big hand because you will. Kevin.
Really want to help us is see those linkages between your elite and our elite. You've got to break those linkages, and you've got to build the linkages between those of us at the grassroots. Pretty straightforward. I just want to start by Susan George. It was mentioned Susan unfortunately has bronchitis. She couldn't be here today. Unfortunate. She's one of our stalwart troops. She sent a message. I'm going to read just a portion of it to represent her spirit here. She's talking about the problems with the World Bank and the IMF. I'm assuming this is not going to come out of my time, right? She says, if I were to get absolute freedom to dictate policy, I would say something like this. First, both the fund and the World Bank must absolutely renounce the debts owed them, certainly by the poorest 42 countries, quite probably beyond that. I don't want to have to read one more obscene response like the funds to Mozambique. It said this to the poorest of all poor countries, ravaged by floods. Okay, you don't have to pay $100 million this year, only $73 million. Second, in spite of the World Bank's frequent cosmetic changes, and for the many years I have studied it, it has always been, quote, the bank that is changing, unquote. This institution, just like the IMF, has a criminal record. Aside from structural adjustment for which the fund must take major responsibility and about which you are likely to hear a good deal today, the bank's performance in such areas as greenhouse gases, resettlement, quote-unquote, programs, large dams, etc., is abysmal on the human environmental levels. Add to this the fact that its less obviously destructive projects either don't work or we don't have a clue if they work because there is little or no evaluation 5 to 10 years down the road, or they work only for the elites and the crony classes. I can't see much argument here. She concludes by saying, these institutions have had their chance. And every time I hear somebody wail, but what would you put in their place? I am tempted to ask, and what would you put in the place of cancer? Actually, there's a very deep theoretical point embedded in that, and that is there is only one thing in nature that has the same growth, growth, growth ideology as this current market economy, and that's a malignant tumor. And what does a malignant tumor do? A malignant tumor eventually destroys the host, and this economic system that we've got on the planet is destroying our planetary host. She concludes by saying, the only rational answer is the absence of cancer. That's what you replace cancer with, the absence of cancer. She says, so good luck to you all as you go out April 16th and 17th to deliver the message. You are the messengers of history. Thank you, Susan. One quick announcement. We need some recruits April 19th at 9 a.m. in Wilmington, Delaware. If you're going to be anywhere near Wilmington, Delaware, we have a little action going on at the Coca-Cola shareholders meeting. This is going to be, get your pens out to write this down. We're pressuring them to pass a resolution that Coke will not buy genetically modified ingredients. They're one of the biggest, if not the biggest purchaser of genetically modified high fructose corn syrup. Ugh, I don't drink that crap anyway. But, you know, so we've got a little inside-outside. We're all on the same side action. We've got shareholders who own over $90 million worth of stock voting that stock for this measure, and we'll have some people out on the street as well, and the media will be there. So any of you troops who can show up, we sure would appreciate that. It's going to be Wednesday, April 19th, 9 a.m. at the DuPont building, appropriately enough, at 10th and Market. 10th and Market. So the significance of Seattle, I have a new book, Globalize This, about that deals with what happened in Seattle. We rushed to get this ready for today. Seattle was the coming out party for the other globalization, grassroots globalization, people's globalization, majority globalization, our democratic, bottom-up globalization that says, thank you very much, sir, that says, I agree with you wholeheartedly, that says, instead of the money cycle dominating the life cycle, let's have the life cycle dominate the money cycle. We could probably get that into a bumper sticker, actually. There, for you bumper sticker makers in the crowd, there's a bit of public education. Look at the victories we've had coming off of Seattle. The other day we had a celebration outside some Starbucks here. Starbucks has agreed to sell fair trade coffee, sign a licensing agreement with Transfer USA. Who'd have thunk it? When we were planning the Transfer USA 5-year strategy, we put Starbucks 4 or 5 years down the road as a target, and all of a sudden they fall into our lap. Because when Global Exchange sent them our plan, telling them we were going to do a national campaign to put pressure on them by going outside in front of their stores and explaining what plantation sweatshop coffee is compared to fair trade coffee, better price for the farmers, ecological production, credit for the farmers, schools, clinics, etc., they realized they were doomed and they just capitulated, okay? They surrendered. We also, a coalition came together and just recently, a few days ago, the beginning of this week, we had a press conference that was packed with press, and we announced the initiation of a World Bank bond boycott campaign. The bank gets over 75% of its capital from selling bonds in the commercial bond markets. They use our tax money as collateral to leverage these bonds in the bond markets. And they have a AAA rating because it's sovereign debt. It's based on we the people. So, you know, as Jim Hightower says, there's no building too big that a little dog can't lift its leg and wee-wee on it. We're going to wee-wee on that AAA rating of the World Bank bonds. And when we chip that AAA rating down to AA, all those investment managers who, after this week, had every reason to know we were going to knock down the value of those bonds, they are going to be liable to their shareholders and investors coming to them saying, you idiot! You knew there was this campaign to drop the AAA rating and drop the value of those bonds, and you invested my money in those bonds anyway, and now I'm losing money because of you. Don't you have a fiduciary responsibility to us shareholders? Okay. So we're going to get them. And the reason I know this is a good strategy is immediately when we announced this campaign, both the Washington Post editorial page and the World Bank themselves said, this is crazy. Thank you very much for that benediction. So now we do have to know how to celebrate and all that, but I want to focus on a problem. Arnold Palmer, the golfer, says when you go out to practice golf, you don't practice the irons and woods you're good at. You practice the one you're worst at. So we got to look at what's our problem coming out of Seattle. If you break the Seattle protests into two basic groups, the AFL-CIO trade unions who had 30 to 40,000 people out there, and the Direct Action Network and the other street protesters who actually did the blockade of the IMF, let's call the blockaders the internationalists. Let's call us the internationalists. The AFL-CIO has a political vehicle so that after Seattle, they can go back to Washington and meet with Al Gore and other leaders of the Democratic Party. They have an institutional vehicle to vie for power and change policies. Us internationalists, we don't have a political vehicle. So what we've got to do is create an ongoing festival of resistance, an institutional vehicle that is transnational, that is for demilitarization, that is for gender equity, that's anti-racist, that embodies all these values that have come out and coalesced in this struggle. So the question is, how can we consolidate and institutionalize this amazing unity that is developing since Seattle? I want to propose something very specific, and in fact, this is already, the gears are moving on this. We had a meeting with some funders about this. I want to propose a global citizen center, a building here in Washington that will be a coalition unity building institution. The funders will pay for the infrastructure, the building, the, you know, copy machines and phones and all that kind of stuff. And the grassroots organizations that don't already have a presence in Washington, no offense to IPS or anybody else who's based here in Washington, they'll be welcome, they'll be part of the party. But this is so that grassroots organizations can have representatives in Washington, and we'll pay their salaries. Global Exchange and Rainforest Action Network, Ruckus Society, all these different groups will send a staff person, rotating, you know, every year or two, rotate them out so they don't get the inside the beltway syndrome, you know. And our goal is not to have access to the policymakers. Our goal is to make the policymakers want to have access to us. Right? Make them come to us. So the staff of this global citizen center, and I think just use of the word global citizen will force us to define, what does that mean? What is a global citizen? So we can start to undermine nationalistic thinking, which... As Barbara Ehrenreich showed in her book, Blood Rights, nationalism is devil worship. It's a great book. Read it. So these people are answerable to the grassroots. So we have a voice then in Washington that consolidates all these parts of the movement into a unified voice, and they're answerable and accountable to the grassroots. It's unity building, not only within the United States, but transnationally. It can do things like reality tours where we bring up comrades from the global south and tour them around these institutions so they can understand the workings of the empire and see how these institutions actually function. We can also bring people from the hustings of the United States to see how their capital works, how their tax money is spent. If that's not going to radicalize you, I lived here 5 years, it radicalized me more than any book, anything I've ever heard or read, just seeing how this system works up close. We can also be, this would also be a clearinghouse of information. It would be a clearinghouse of emotional connectedness, linking people up to struggles all around the world, bringing these struggles together. It would be, in a sense, a permanent mobilization. This mobilization that's going on here and the mobilization that went on around Seattle is great, but we don't want to be dependent on only mobilizing when these clowns have their big meetings and their conferences, because you know what they're going to do? They're going to move their conferences to Beijing or Dahran or Qatar. That's actually being discussed already in these institutions, where they can hide, where they have enough repressive force to hide from us on their next meetings. So it would be an ongoing festival of alternatives. And we would have regular social events so that the term political party gets redefined to have a double meaning on the word party. Yeah? Like fiesta, right? And this is something we really have to take our hats or our wigs or whatever off to the youth. The youth are the ones who have redefined political party. When you see the puppets and the dancing and the music and all that fun in that festival, because think, those of us in the progressive community for decades, I wrote my first article on the IMF 25 years ago. Ooh, it's pathetic. We've been saying to the public, and that's the main target, that's the bullseye, that's our terrain of struggle, is the public mind. We have to win over the mass mind, the public mind, to our values and our critique of the system. We're great at critique. We've been saying, that boat you people are riding in is a bad boat. Jump out of it. Into what? Shark-infested waters? We have to create, and we are creating with the Fair Trade Network and socially responsible tourism and eco-labeling and all these different international campaigns, we're creating an alternative boat. So imagine they're up there in the Titanic. We come by on our boat, and there's a party going on with cool music. Everybody's got a drink in their hand. You know, out on the deck, they'll want to jump over to our boat. All right? And then what's going to happen is, a few years down the road, or maybe a year or two down the road, this global citizen center will proliferate around the world. So we'll have global citizen centers in Johannesburg and Madrid and Porto Alegre and Jakarta and all sorts of places all around the world. They will be safe houses. They will be places where people come together to build the movement, where each organization is able to subordinate its organizational ego to the movement. Just as in a good meeting, when you're sitting around a table with 10 or 20 people, a good meeting is when every individual can subordinate their ego to the group effort. We have to do that at the movement level now. And look at this mobilization. It's a coalition of coalitions. Is that amazing or what? We're up to that level of organizational sophistication. The head of the D.C. police said just recently in a media interview, "I can't believe the level of organization of this movement. We've never seen this level of organization before." Pretty amazing. This global network of global citizen centers, GICs, I guess you'd call them, or something like that. One of the things we're going to do is we're going to do global voting, right? Global plebiscite. We'll organize by transferring lots of hardware and software down to the global south so everybody can be wired up to the network. You know, when people talk about the computer revolution, you got to remind them 80% of the people in the world don't have telephones, okay? So we got a lot of work redistributing the hardware, but we can do that. We go to the law firms and say, hey, when you get rid of, you know, each year or two when you get new computers, you donate them to us, you get your tax write-off, and we'll distribute them down to our partners in the global south. We'll get everybody wired up and we'll do global voting. And we'll say, should we shut down all the militaries and save $800 billion a year? Right? What are people going to say? Are people going to vote? You know, should we have gender equity? Right? Should we destroy the environment or save it? Should we have any starving children? Or should we have no starving children? These are pretty straightforward questions. My 9-year-old daughter could get these all right. And that process will then lay the foundation for the formation of a global citizen party. A political party that is transnational, that runs candidates in all countries, where the part of the party in the northern countries transfer funds and technology and assistance to the Mali, Bolivia, Ecuadors of the world to help them out because of their lack of material resources, and will build what all the great spiritual leaders have told us to do. Make a planet where every male and female relates to every other male and female as a brother and a sister. That's what they all said. All of the spiritual leaders said the same thing. So, when you leave here, you're all hereby anointed to be recruiters to the movement. Recruit, recruit, recruit. That's our motto. Build the movement. Build the movement. It's not me. It's we. We have to build a we ideology. We've got too much me ideologies. That's the basis of capitalism. Me, my stock portfolio, my career, my salary. No, forget that. We need a we ideology, and that's what we're constructing. So when you go out there on the street, April 16th and 17th, I want you to keep this one thing in your mind. The word revolutionary, when you take the first 5 letters of that word and you turn them backwards, it spells L-O-V-E-R, lover. Isn't that nice? So let's go out there as revolutionaries and lovers and let's change the planet. Thank you very much.
Man can do anything, so I'm going to put in a personal request. Kevin, congratulations to you and to Global Exchange and all those people who got the fair trade thing with Starbucks. Now let's take it one step further. Starbucks is destroying small family-owned cafes in this country. Let's put them out of business now. Let's make it real fair trade. We have all this energy and momentum. We are not going to stop halfway through. We're going to get the whole thing. Our next speaker is Teddy Edward Goldsmith, who is one of the pioneers of the ecological movement in the UK, and for the last three decades has been involved in campaigns against the nuclear industry, large dams, the World Bank, and the FAO. He has stood as a Green Party candidate at three elections and has taught at many universities, including Michigan University. As a staff member at Bard College, he helped set up an international honors program, Global Ecology Course. He is the founding editor of The Ecologist. We all know The Ecologist, which was trashed because of what Monsanto did, the same magazine Ecologist, and is author of numerous works, including A Blueprint for Survival, that triggered the foundation of the British Green Party. He wrote The Great U-Turn, The Social and Environmental Effects of Large Dams with Nicholas Hilliard, and The Way, an Ecological Worldview. I'm going to finish this, and before I get, you know, English is not my native language. I get very scared that I'm going to lose my words. So let me just complete it. In 1991, he was awarded the Right Livelihood Award in Stockholm, which is also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. And his newest work is The Case Against the Global Economy, that red book, done, co-authored with, co-edited with Jerry Mander. I have my own story about Teddy. I first met Teddy as a student in India. You know, we used to run around trying to find those people who could inspire the other, you know, students. And he was the one who was always so accessible, and we would do radio shows. And I met him many years later, and much to my surprise, he still recognized me. It felt good. So in terms of The Ecologist magazine did a whole issue on Monsanto called the Monsanto Files. Monsanto got word of it and actually threatened the printer, and printer basically got rid of all 10,000 copies. Now, they made the biggest mistake because they didn't know who were the people behind it, because Teddy and others made sure that other, you know, ecologists in other languages, including Spanish and other languages, which was not done by Teddy, but other groups who were so angry because a right to information was being taken away, they put it out there. So more power to us. Teddy.
Well, we've had some, I think we've had some wonderful speakers today. I certainly have difficulty to get together a group of people like that in England at this moment, I think. What I know is if I wanted to start a real political party to take on the existing ones, the man I choose would be Daddy, where's he got to? Kevin Dagger. I don't think anybody could compete with him. Well, a few comments about what the previous speakers said. First of all, I think it's important that we realize we cannot reform the World Bank. That is an impossibility. And Herman Daly knows this too, because I visited him when he tried to reform the World Bank with two or three other very talented dissidents. And last time I went to see him, his office was in the basement. And he said, you can see that I'm not exactly succeeding because I used to be on the fifth floor, you see? At least they can't demote me any further because there are no wine cellars in this building. Mm-hmm. The point is, it can't be reformed. I even wrote a letter to Mr. Wolfenson when he became head and explained to him in great length why it can't be reformed. And to my astonishment, he answered me. And he agreed. He said, I sympathize considerably with what you're saying, but I'm going to change everything. And as we've heard today, he has not really changed. He's made cosmetic changes, as Susan George has said, but he has not changed it in substance, nor can he. I remember one of the reasons, one of the times that Herman Daly was demoted in the World Bank is when he opposed the building of the Sardar Sarovar Dam on the Narmada River. He's there in front of me. And he wanted to stop this, and there was absolute pandemonium when he suggested it, because a bank has got to lend a lot of money, and when they can't find a more or less viable country that's not bankrupt, that's willing to spend a few billion dollars on a dam, they rejoice and open the champagne bottles. And Herman is going to put a stop to this. He's really unsportsmanlike, and that, I think, earned his move from the operations department to the planning department. I don't know if I'm right, Herbert. It just can't be done. Well, I first found out about the World Dam when I was holidaying in Sri Lanka, one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I suppose I'm a bit of a masochist. I suppose I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing for so long if I hadn't have a streak. If I didn't have a streak of masochism in me, and I ended up looking at their dams and also their traditional irrigation systems. I saw in particular the Victoria Dam, funded by the Overseas Development Agency, our equivalent of the USAID. And that led me to look into this in great detail. I spent 4 years at it with a colleague of mine, and we did the three-volume book on the social and environmental effects of large dams. The third one was a review of the literature. We actually went through 500 books and articles. I must have been mad in those days. 500 books and articles on the subject. And after I did this, I realized we did not find a single example of a big dam built in the tropics that was not only human, social, ecological, and economic disaster. I didn't find one. So needless to say, I mean, we all know that the problems, the ecological problems, the salinization of the land, the best land we have in the river valleys, the waterlogging of this land, you know, the total destruction of the forests all around, all the different ecological problems, the spread of waterborne diseases, which always occurs. But it's also a human disaster because it leads to the displacement of vast, vast numbers of people. In the Lokayan, very good Indian, one of the best Indian journals on these issues, they say that since 1950, 21 million people have been displaced from their lands in India alone. And of those, about 16 million have been displaced by big dams. So if you just take India alone and look at the rest of the world, like China, where they've built even more dams than other countries, you could probably take a figure of 100 million people, which I think is a figure that Vandana Shiva takes, who have been displaced by development programs funded by the World Bank and others, whose overt goal is to fight poverty. Now, it can't be a very successful means of fighting poverty if it leads to the displacement of 100 million people from their land, maybe two-thirds by big dams. A lot of these funded by the World Bank. And the World Bank's main excuse for surviving, you know, for not closing down many of its departments, you know, which has been suggested by, I think, a congressional committee here, is that otherwise the poor would suffer so much. You need the World Bank to fight poverty. And it is one of the greatest creators of poverty of all time, by pushing millions and millions, tens of millions of people into the slums of the major cities. Now this, of course, it's an economic disaster because, for many reasons. First of all, people only will agree to order a dam if it's not too expensive. So they pretend it's always much cheaper than they really are. They end up by costing 2, 3, 4 times more. Worse still, these things tend to silt up very quickly because you get erosion, which they didn't cater for. So all the soil falls into the river and it blocks it all up. It silts up the dam, the reservoir. The dam becomes useless. Now, this has happened in one document I've seen on World Bank dams in India, 7 times faster than expected, which means that each one of those dams cost correspondingly more because they would have to be amortized over a correspondingly shorter period. So they're all economic disasters too, and they end up by being paid for by the taxpayers. You know, that's where they pay it eventually. Anyhow, so much for dams. But then I looked at another issue where I also saw, before I move to this other issue, clearly then people don't build dams for the reasons the overt reasons that they proclaim. They've got a very different agenda. It's quite a, what is the agenda? Well, first of all, who profits from these dams? And the answer is the builders, the contractors, they make a mint, the governments, and governments of the different states, because they get huge kickbacks. I've been told in India that about 50% of the aid money, monies lent by the bank and everything else, are stolen by the politicians and by the contractors, who are allowed to make much bigger profits, which they probably share with the politicians. I'm told that in Brazil it's 80%. I don't know if anybody has figures on these things. That's a figure I've been given by somebody quite high up there in Brazil. Well, so they got a different agenda. It's that different. Everybody profits from building these dams. The dam makers, we, the Western governments here, because we sell all the turbines. Our companies quite often build these things. Everybody profits from these things, except for all the people, except for poor people who are displaced, and for the natural world, which is completely ruined. So here we are. When I started looking at feeding the world, about the same time, we're talking about 20 years ago, I started looking at all that. Here again, I can see that the World Bank, which to begin with, its main function was to fund infrastructural projects like big dams and harbors and airports so that the third world could trade with us. That was the object of the whole thing. Then they moved into pushing the Green Revolution. Well, Green Revolution really means high input agriculture. Now, it's perfectly clear to me, I won't go into this in great detail, I'm sure the Vandana Shiva is going to talk to you about this, that, and the gene revolution that followed in some detail. But basically, it meant pushing high input agriculture. And on theoretical grounds alone, it is absolutely impossible for high input agriculture to feed the world. How can it? Because the small farmers can't afford the inputs. So they're pushed into the slums. Because in order to earn the foreign exchange, to pay interest on the loans contracted to build the factories, to build the dams, to provide the irrigation water, etc., to buy all the inputs, they've got to export all the food, which they do in any case. So there's no longer any good land left in the third world to produce food for local people. The main cause of malnutrition in the third world is the export business. It is a fact that land, all the good land, is used for export crops, so there's no longer any land left to feed people. I flew over KwaZulu-Natal. It is to me, you all know that in the WTO, among the WTO regulations, countries have got to, they're forced to export food so long as there's a market for it. Even today, even according to the latest regulations passed by the Uruguay rounds, if I remember rightly, even if people in their own country are starving. That wasn't in an original rule, if I remember. For me, I mean, the idea of exporting food in a huge way from a country like India, where we're between 40 and 60% children are known to be malnourished, is absolutely criminal. Now, this is what the World Bank is pushing. That's what it pushes, at the WTO as well, but they're all brothers and sisters. They work together, the same thing. They're pushing this as well. Now, not only then are the peasants pushed into the slums, and the food is exported, so there's no food left for local people, but the land is then turned into dust by this chemical agriculture. Much of the land of the third world, not everywhere, but much of the land is much more vulnerable to erosion than it is in temperate areas, because its organic content is much lower, and because the rains, when they come, they all come at once and they wash away the stuff. So in fact, what they are trying to do by forcing high input agriculture on the third world, otherwise called modern agriculture, is to push the peasants into the slums, export the food, and turn the agricultural land into dust. Now, no one can tell me that this is a sensible way of feeding people. No one can tell me that by doing this, they're even trying to feed people. Trying to feed people is not part of the deal. FAO in Rome is not involved in feeding people. We did a special issue of The Ecologist in which we accused the FAO of being the main agent of malnutrition and famine in the world. And we raided their offices and their meetings for some time. You see, it's perfectly clear this is not. They've got a totally different agenda. And there again, it's the same thing. Who are the beneficiaries of this high-input agriculture? Quite obviously, our governments and our corporations. If we in England push this, it's because we want Balfour Beatty, our main building company, or Bechtel, to build the dams and sell the turbines. We want to get sales for Fison's fertilizers. We want Shell Chemicals to sell the pesticides. We want AstraZeneca to sell their hybrid seeds or genetic engineered seeds. In other words, we want our corporations to sell the inputs. That's why we push that. Now, Mr. Blair is just as bad as your Mr. Clinton, and always predecessors Mrs. Thatcher, who is outdone, in fact. Give a damn whether Africans or Indians starve to death. What they want to do is sell inputs to the third world. So you see, if you look, the more you look at these problems, the more cynical you can get. I was fairly innocent and gullible when I was young. I become more cynical every year, when it's perfectly clear to me that nothing we are doing is really trying to solve problems. In fact, I don't think there's anyone who's paid in any of our institutions, state institutions or international institutions, to solve problems. Their agenda is a quite different one. And this is true for me of the setting up of these institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, etc. The WTO followed, of course. It was the GATT. They wanted to have the ITO, but it didn't get through. In any case, it was set up after the war. And now we must ask, this is why, we want to work out what is their agenda. Why were these things set up in the first place? For me, all three of these institutions were set up as tools, and very specialized, and very specific tools, for the implementation of a special policy. And what was this policy? The answer, it's Bretton Woods. The answer is simply to bring the whole third world into the orbit of the Western industrial system so that our corporations could continue expanding, so that they'd have a continually expanding market for their products, continually expanding source of cheap raw materials and cheap labor. I don't have to tell you that this is exactly the same goal of British colonialism in the 19th century. Let me tell you, let me quote one of the main architects of the British imperial system, Cecil Rhodes, after whom Rhodesia is named. He said to Parliament, "We must find new lands from which we can easily obtain raw materials and at the same time exploit the cheap slave labor that is available from the natives of the colonies. The colonies must also provide a dumping ground for the surplus goods produced in our factories." It says it all. There is absolutely no difference between that program and the program set up at Bretton Woods to bring the third world into the orbit of the Western system. The difference is that the first was called colonialism, the second is called development. They're the same. They're the same. Free trade was the chosen device for achieving this goal at Bretton Woods. Sounds good, free trade. You know, the level playing field, establishes a level playing field. But what we haven't been told, and people don't seem to realize, is that the level playing field is a great place for the powerful to operate on, not for the weak. If I wanted to confront Mr. Mike Tyson, I wouldn't want to do so on a level playing field. If Britain imposed free trade on the world in 1860 to 1873, it's because Britain was the most powerful country in the world. We had the greatest economy, the world's only big financial center, and we had a navy. And if anyone didn't do what we said, we sent out the navy to fix that problem. And it's no coincidence that it's America that is the most powerful country in the world in 1944. That's why they imposed free trade. And it's because of this free trade. What is free trade? Well, it's not even free trade what we have today. Free trade is really the removal of tariffs. We've gone way beyond that. With our non-tariff barriers and all the other things, we are now creating conditions in which we are removing systematically every single law, regardless of why it was set up, if it happens to upset the interests of the corporations, if it reduces their profits. It doesn't matter if this law is essential for protecting the poor, the unemployed, the old, the sick, local communities, local economies, the natural world, to prevent global warming. Who gives a damn? If it reduces the interests of the corporations, it is disallowed. It's got to go. There's even a law that says that. There's a thing. It's not in the World Trade Organization, to my knowledge. It's in the NAFTA treaty, and they would have brought it in the MAI, which has unfortunately failed. They tried to get it in again in Seattle. It would have been imposed again. It's a law that says I think it's, is it called the non-violation clause? I can't remember. But nevertheless, this is what it says. If a government passes a measure that reduces the profits of a corporation, even if this measure does not violate any of the WTO regulations, now this is the most amazing, even if it doesn't, it still is illegal, and the company that suffers can seek compensation on the basis of the profits which on their own reckoning they would have made if the thing had not been disallowed. And this has been used several times. Already the Ethyl Corporation thing against Canada sued the Canadian government for $250 million. It didn't get it, but it got something, because the government of Canada wouldn't allow them to sell in Canada MMT, some poisonous additive for gas. And they got it. There we are. I've got to come to an end. What I'm going to say, in any case, that what we're looking there is not just deregulation, it is also re-regulation. We're not just removing laws that interfere with the interests of these corporations. We are replacing them with laws that protect their interests. You see, laws are designed to protect small communities and everything else are being replaced by laws designed to protect the interests of the corporations. So you'll get what we're getting is a new form of protectionism. But we're protecting the interests of the corporations instead of the interests of local people, local communities, and the national environment. But I won't go much further. I think I've said my bit. My conclusion is that we can't go further in this direction. If we go much further, we will make what is not possible. We can't. You see, I just take one of the things I talked about, which is the displacement of peoples today. If we go ahead with commodifying, with privatizing, or rather opening the rural areas of the third world to the corporations, which is what we plan to do. Now, it wasn't allowed in India. There's a law against corporations buying land. That law has been rescinded. And now already McDonald's has bought a lot of land in India, and there are other corporations buying it. If they go along doing this, if suddenly we decide to commercialize the subsistence agriculture in India, well, we're going to have about 700 million people to push off the land. That is to say, about 500 million small farmers who farmed 2, 3, or 4 acres, and all of the small shopkeepers, street vendors, artisans who depend on the farming community, they are condemned. You know yourself that you cannot survive with a farm of 2 or 3 acres. And when you start development and industrialization, they will go to the slums. You will have slums of 50, 60 million people, not just in India, but in China and elsewhere. We are seeing a process there which is impossible. And what we're trying to do is impossible on many, many counts, including the fact that we are now heading in the direction of global warming, by far and away the most serious problem we've ever faced. If we don't take action today, this planet will be uninhabitable, probably this century. So it is absolutely urgent that we put an end to what's happening today, and we shift our society in a totally different direction. For me, to return to something, to a local economy, run by small companies, catering for local and regional markets. Small companies that are controllable by governments, which these corporations are not, and which themselves have an interest in their own citizens. Interest in assuring the continuance of their own communities, as to a certain extent they have did in the past. I don't think there's any alternative but to this. It is the object of that book, which Jerry Mander and I co-edited, which has done rather well. We sold about 40,000 or 50,000 of them in the United States. It's now coming out in a few other countries. I don't think that there's any alternative. The only thing is we don't have much time to waste. We've really got to work hard at it. Many thanks.
You know, I learned a lot of chants in Seattle, and one of them which has stayed with me was, ain't no power like the power of youth, because the power of youth don't stop. And one of the classic examples of that power of youth is the next speaker, a very dear friend, Danny Kennedy. Danny is somebody I met when he was an organizer with ACEAT, a student organization. He was kicking ass with the others around the World Bank and IMF issues, but today he is the director of Project Underground, a Berkeley-based organization which has been challenging the human rights violations of the mining and oil companies. He's been out there, one of those activists who's linking up communities across borders, whether it's issues of what's happening to our communities of color, low-income communities in the U.S., as well as what's happening in the Niger Delta. So let's give a big hand to Danny.
Thank you very much, Anuradha, and thank you all for being here and getting involved. It's amazing to see this crowd. I helped organize a sort of a parallel event in 94 here in DC, and then the 50 Years is Enough stuff in Madrid in 95. And we were trying to mobilize internationally, but this time it's just slightly different. There's this spark in the air, and I think that we're going to really kick ass, as Anuradha's been saying, all morning in this church. I also want to thank the IFG very much for putting me on this panel. It's a great privilege to be on a panel with people that I've learned so much from over the years, not just about the woes of the global economy, but also about the possibility of an economy for people, for the common good, as Herman Daly wrote in a book of that title many years ago. These are wonderful places to go and inform yourself and educate yourself. And better than that, a forum like this that the IFG is now putting on, like some sort of Billy Graham alternative impresario outfit, is a place to also connect to the stuff going on the streets. You can get educated here and you can get activated out there on Sunday and Monday. And that's what we've all got to do, and I'll try and get you to practice some chants before the end of this little talk. I do also want to thank the church for hosting us and the Reverend for introducing us, and I want to apologize in advance for anything I might say. I will stick with the tone set by Anuradha, but sometimes we get carried away in the fury, the righteous rage that we have about these people that would take everything and would own everything and destroy the possibility of a just and sustainable future for us all. And we have to keep that passion and that fire in our bellies as we take this up with these decision makers this week. I also want to apologize to all of you a little bit, and it's a weird sort of thing I'm feeling. I'm embarrassed because I'm Australian, a sort of Australian-American now, a hybrid, and there's another Australian-American that you might have heard about or you should know about, and his name's James Wolfenson. And I know that's only a kind of guilt by association that I have, but it just makes me sick in the stomach to see a compatriot doing what this man's doing. I mean, you know, we're not just talking about psychologically warped, which he is. I mean, he should learn from that old Middle Eastern proverb that the denial ain't just a river in Egypt. This guy is seriously not just misguided, but evil. I honestly want to say that. I am happy to try to demonize, even in the house of the Lord, individual decision makers that perpetrate wrongful acts knowingly, not ignorantly, but knowingly on people and places around the planet. I was in a cab the other day listening to NPR with a Ghanaian cabbie, and he and I both had to pull over because we were gagging, because Wolfenson was on NPR saying that, you know, he just doesn't understand what all the outrage is about, why all these people are coming to town. He said, we mobilize 10,000 people every day for social justice. That was the point when we had to stop the car. There are also lesser villains in this piece that I want you to know by name, and I think that we have to start to pressure and target, because the only thing that creates social change, as we've learnt from all of our forebears and all the movements that we build on and stand on the shoulders of, is endless pressure, endlessly applied. We have to personalize this. We have to hold the powers that be responsible individually. We have to speak truth to them through events like this, through the media, through all the forums we can, but we also have to take it up to them. That's why we want to stop the limousines in the street on Sunday. We want these officials, these elites from these countries that are coming to the JFK Center or wherever they plan to meet, to stop and hear the rage in our voices and reflected from around the world at the abuse of structural adjustment programs and the other policies of the World Bank and the IMF and the global corporate economy that we're suffering from. One of the names I'd like you to get to know is a name I only came across just last year. His name is Doug Lister. Fascinating gentleman, not really. Actually, he's quite boring in person. English educated, I would guess, from some fairly aristocratic background. And I met him at the International Finance Corporation, which is, as you know, the private sector arm of the World Bank. Has a very nice building down here in D.C. and you know, well-paid people walking around, mostly white, and deciding the fate of billions of people around the planet. And Doug's one of those people. And I asked him for his card after our meeting, which I'm going to tell you about. And I looked at his card, and his card said, Doug Lister, International Finance Corporation, Mining Oil and Gas. It didn't say Executive Director or Managing Director or Project Manager or any title. It just said Mining Oil and Gas. And that you know, got the fear of God going in me. It was kind of like, is this man human? Or is he just made of, you know, mining oil and gas? What is that about? What it's about is the fact that the World Bank is the largest funder in the public sector of fossil fuel projects around the world. The International Finance Corporation is nothing other than a direct subsidy institution for mining and oil corporations. You know the story that Daphne described with the Chad Cameron pipeline, which is one of the great outrages currently pending with the World Bank board for decision. The money is going to ExxonMobil and the consortium of companies that will build that pipeline if they try. And ExxonMobil had a GDP 40 times that of Chad last year. It had a GDP 4 times that of Cameroon. So this is a corporation receiving largesse from the public purse, from your tax dollars and mine and raised through bond sales and all the rest of it, to subsidize this corporate malfeasance. This is an outrage which clearly we have to stop. That's not the International Finance Corporation. The IFC is even worse than the other wings of the World Bank, which only fund mining oil and gas to the tune of about 3-4% of their entire portfolios. The International Finance Corporation and its bastard brother, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, which insures private sector developments in the third world, have 16% of their portfolios occupied by financing and funding and organizing insurance for and other loans for holes in the ground. This is in the name of poverty alleviation. That's what the World Bank's about, right? A world full of poverty? No, a world free of poverty, I should say. That's what their slogan is. And yet somehow they think that holes in the ground, care of ExxonMobil, Chevron, Newmont, Freeport, everyone else that they've funded over the years, is a route to alleviate the problems of the people surrounding these projects. Of course, we know this is a lie. We know that they know this is a lie, that the contrary is true, that they will structurally impoverish those communities, that there is a poverty in geology and pursuing a macroeconomic development path which is based on resource exploitation, that the most indebted countries are predominantly countries which pegged their fate on resource exploitation, particularly mineral and oil exploitation. They know all this. Their own statistics bear this out, and yet they continue to perpetrate it, and in fact, the fastest growing portfolios, particularly in the IFC and the MIGA, which are the fastest growing areas of the World Bank's business, are to support mining oil and gas projects. The meeting that I was at in Washington last June to meet with Mr. Doug Lister, Mining Oil and Gas International Finance Corporation, was a meeting with a group of campesinos that we had brought up from northern Peru. These are indigenous people from the north of Peru who were subjected to the quest for gold that Westerners had 500 years ago. You might remember a spate of history under the conquistadors in which these indigenous populations thought that white people ate gold because nothing else could explain their desire and lust to get it. And now, 500 years later, in the very city where Atahualpa was ransomed for a room full of silver and gold to Pizarro, the conquistador, there is another conquistador, Newmont Corporation of Denver, Colorado, raping and pillaging that land yet again, this time with Latin America's largest cyanide-based gold mine. Now, you've only got to go to Romania or North Carolina or Colorado or Papua New Guinea in the last month to find out the problems with cyanide-based gold mining. This is the poison we used in Auschwitz, remember? We're now putting it on the ground all over the planet next to drinking water in order to extract tiny fractions of gold. That's the whole point of the cyanide extraction technology. It gets it out at like 0.003 grams per ton. So for every bar of gold, you get 3 billion bar equivalents of waste rock laced with cyanide from this process. The Newmont gold mine in northern Peru is the largest mining concession area in Latin America. And that is land that they intend and could literally grind up and turn into powder and spray with cyanide and extract these tiny fractions of gold from if they have their way. Get this. The World Bank owns 5% of it. They own 5% of it. They didn't just provide loans to set it up, which is their usual way of behaving. They didn't just arrange other private creditors to finance the expansion of the mine, although they did that as well. They actually own 5% of it. So we bought campesinos from the surrounding community, 60,000 of whom have been directly impacted by this, 10,000 of whom have been displaced by this mine. We bought representatives of their federation to meet with the IFC because the IFC had failed to meet with them ever before. They had never been consulted as an organization. And this Federation of Rondas Campesinas of Northern Peru is a constitutionally recognized indigenous organization in Peru. So it's not like they could have missed it when they did their social impact assessment. They have failed to talk to them in the 8 years that this mine's been operating. So we brought them here instead. And this man, the rather boring Englishman that does mining oil and gas for the IFC, he sat there impassively, hardly said a word, and hasn't got back to us since. We had two people, one a woman called Segunda Castrion Vallejo, who is a remarkable leader of her community and just an amazing firebrand of an activist, who currently, unfortunately, is being charged with terrorism under Peruvian laws because of a protest that she was involved in on the road on the way to the mine and a previous incident where she hit the mayor of the local town on the head with her shoe because she was so upset by the whole thing. We're trying to get them legal advice to help get off that because it's obviously a very serious charge and just a small taste of the kind of repression that communities like this face all the time at the front line of these bank and funded projects. But Segunda was passionate, very polite, but very strong. She stood up, she was crying, she was showing pictures of her land, which she had been told she could come back to after it had been mined, but which is now literally a gaping hole. Literally a pit, nearly, you know, hundreds of feet deep. Now, this was unmoving to these people. And so we have to move them. We have to represent Segunda on Sunday. Segunda has given us her blessing, and the Federation of Rondas Campesinas, though they won't be represented here, we are bringing them up for Newmont's annual meeting next month in Denver, have given the blessing of their efforts to the whole convergence here to try and take down the World Bank and the IMF because of the damage they do to their land. There's another community organization that I want to speak for, and again, I'm embarrassed to say this because I think people should speak for themselves, and I'm glad that the next set of speakers will be reports from around the planet, and you'll hear more directly from on the ground at the blunt end, the ugly cutting edge of the global economy. But there is a community network that we at Project Under work with, resisting oil exploitation and exploration around the world, called Oil Watch. And they have also released a statement in commemoration and support of this historic moment here in DC, calling for an end to mining oil and gas investment by the World Bank immediately. Not tomorrow, not next week, not later, but now. And we need to respect these demands and we need to put them and place them on the doorstep of the institutions and let them hear that. The reason we need to do this on the oil end of the game is because the World Bank, as I said earlier, is the largest funder of fossil fuel development in the public sector in the world. It's an amazing thing to think about. The figures that Daphne cited about the fact that they spend 25 times more on fossil fuel development and global warming creation, effectively, than renewable energy development is an abomination. It is truly disturbing and disgusting and something which we have to correct. Later on, you'll be meeting tonight Aronto Douglas, who's here from Nigeria, who was a lawyer for the late, great Ken Saro-Wiwa, who raised the world's attention to the pillage of the oil industry in the Niger Delta. Aronto has at various times in the last several years had to live underground, quite literally, with a price on his head at different times. And he has organized and continued to work with the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people and a more broad pan-ethnic movement, including his own minority, the Ijaw in Nigeria, to start to shake the very foundations of that state, which was set up in the interests of the oil companies. Now, Aronto will tell you more about this, but another project which the bank may consider funding and has been currently denying that they're considering funding, but previously was considering funding, and we can't believe anything these people say, is a pipeline from Nigeria to Ghana with gas. It's called the West Africa Gas Pipeline, and the gas will fuel an energy system run by a U.S. corporation, of course, in Ghana, which will basically provide energy to gold mines in Ghana. These gold mines are the same as the ones in Peru and the same as the ones in Nevada, destroying the lives of the Western Shoshone people, cyanide-based gold mines. And guess what? The World Bank's funding 3 out of 6 of them in the Ghanaian case. In West Africa, the fastest-growing line item of IFC lending of late has certainly been in gold mining, which is a scourge going across the planet, which you can read more about in this paper, which I wanted to introduce just on my way to conclusion, which is to say that we're all here to shut down the bank, as far as I'm concerned, even if it's for a day, even if it's just to shake them out of their supine slumber, as it were, that as Herman put it, to make them realize, wake up and smell the coffee, that things are changing. The exciting thing about this moment and the difference between now and previous years is the vitality and the energy which the young people bring, which the artists bring to this, which the creativity and humor that we're all using in this actually brings to the task of abolishing this institution. And I must say, you've probably picked me. I'm in the abolitionist end of the spectrum, right? It can't be reformed as an institution, I'm speaking of the World Bank, when at its very constitutional basis it requires that an American heads the bank. The President, James Wolfensohn, didn't change his nationality just to pay better taxes to the US government. He had to change it in order to take this position. That very fact, and the fact that the International Monetary Fund requires a European head, is racist. It is intentionally exclusionary. It is intentionally exclusionary to the majority of the world's population and the people whom these institutions claim to serve, but in truth, who they are hurting most. The people that these institutions serve are the CEOs and the shareholders and the investors and beneficiaries of corporate America, of corporate Australia, of corporate Japan and Europe. These corporations exert a disturbing level of influence and governance over us in our lives. There's a lot of talk in the United States about need for campaign finance reform and getting dirty money out of politics. At the global level, this global pillage instead of village that we've entered into in the 21st century, we really have a problem until we take down corporate rule. And the pillars of corporate rule are these institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, which we threatened just last year. To learn more about it, I want you all to get this Washington Times called The Washington Minds that we put out yesterday. It explicates some of the issues that we work on at Project Underground, supporting the human rights of communities resisting mining and oil exploitation. Also, if you have internet access, check out www.worldbank.org, but not World Bank as in W-O-R-L-D, but World as in Whirling Dervish, the W-H-I-R-L-E-D bank.org. It's a satirical website where you can even play an interactive game and try with real macroeconomic figures to pay off the debt of a developing country of your choice. And You can slash all the public spending you like, you can slash all the education and health care that you want, and you can't do it because it's an impossible treadmill that those people are on, trying to pay off odious debts probably accrued by dictators in years before their kids were born, which is why we have this thing on the back. Got debt? This kid does. And lastly, before I go, I wanted to get you all up and practicing a little slogan which we created for the purpose of this week. It's, excuse me as I say this, World Bank, get your ass out of mining oil and gas. And what I want to propose is that I'll say the words World Bank, and then the top deck up there says, get your ass, and the bottom deck down here says, out of mining oil and gas. Okay? So it's World Bank, get your ass out of mining oil and gas. I'm giving that to the top group just in case there is a problem with saying ass in a church, so that you're closer to God. And this is good practice. This is good practice for Sunday, because I expect you all, regardless of whether you can join in the direct action or not, to be at the blockades, on the barricades, as these people run the gauntlet in their limousines, and as we speak truth to power and we tell them we will not have any more of this nonsense, that we want the bank's abuse and the funds abuse to stop. And in my case, I want you to learn this slogan. So we'll just do this five times in the interest of time. Okay, you've all got your lines down. All right. World Bank,
get your ass out of mining
oil and gas. World Bank,
get your ass out of mining oil and gas.
World Bank,
get your ass out of mining
oil and gas. World Bank,
get your ass out of mining
oil and gas. World Bank,
get your ass out of mining oil and gas.
Thank you.
Now, I'll tell you one thing. As an Indian woman, how I define patriarchy. Patriarchy is not just something that happens between man and woman, you know, or a man and a woman, you know, within the four walls of the house. We are defining the logic of the World Bank, the IMF, and the WTO as patriarchy. So, every time you meet anyone who talks about that they're out there helping us, they're providing us jobs, teaching us about human rights, teaching us about democracy, tell them, instead of meeting in Washington, D.C., try to meet in the Chiapas, or try taking your meeting to India. We'll teach them a lesson there, and since they're not doing that, we'll have to teach them a lesson right here in Washington, D.C. And any of you who have not been to the Convergence Center, I'll make a plea, go there. I went there yesterday, and as I walked in, I had tears in my eyes. You saw those faces of hope. You saw what the future of this America could be. And we have to make sure that is the future of this country, because that would have an impact on the future of this world. There are going to be young people on the streets of Washington, D.C. There are going to be workers, they're going to be moms and dads, they're going to be all of us who will be there. Let's march together. Let's march together for universal human rights. This is not going to be about human rights in China or in Indonesia or Burma. This is going to be about human rights in this world. It's going to be about and as Danny said, it is racist. It is racist when a U.S. person, citizen, can only head the World Bank. So we will tell them that we are global citizens. We are the global people of this world who have come out for social and economic justice, whether it's about the migrant farm workers in this country, whether it's about those children who are executed here, whether it's about Mumia, or whether it's about those people in Ecuador who have basically said no to those IMF policies, and of course the media is calling it a coup. So let's march together, let's celebrate together, and don't leave, because Jerry has a few announcements to make.